Hello. Our next session is about automatic page migration in the kernel in the sort of area of non-uniform memory access system. I'll hand you over straight away to Lee Schemerhorn. To talk about that. He works for HP. He's developed some patches in this area, and he's going to talk about that now. And if you want to ask any questions, can you wait for me to come up to you with a microphone? Thanks.
Okay. Let me get started here. I'm going to talk about automatic page migration, some patches I've done. The matter of hygiene there, some of you may be wondering about that. And the cynics among you are probably thinking it's just a crass attempt on my part to raise the visibility of this in the eyes of the program committee. And to that I say, I'm not the only one, and it worked. So, in lieu of an agenda, let me tell you what I'm going to tell you, and I'll stick that up, which is something I like to put up. I don't want to do a complete taxonomy of NUMA systems, because that's been done. You can go Google some papers that were done at that other Linux conference a couple years ago. The Gogan paper is particularly good at looking at NUMA systems and all of the issues that the OS has to deal with. There are a couple of papers by SGI engineers. I have references at the end who talk about all the things they had to do to get Linux to scale on NUMA systems and such. But I do need to set some context. So, you know, why NUMA? Oh, there's another paper by Bly in 2004 OLS where he has a subsection on this. And he may not say the same things I do, but this is my view because I'm the one speaking. And we build NUMA systems to provide sufficient bandwidth that we can create, you know, honking big SMPs, as Greg Banks calls them, or what people like to think of as SMPs. It gives customers a warm fuzzy when you run the single system image that it works just like an SMP. And we build those out of multiple low CPU count SMP nodes or cells or system building blocks or whatever you want to call them. And typically that cell will have sufficient internal bandwidth, one hopes. That's not always the case, but sufficient internal interconnect bandwidth and bus bandwidth to satisfy the needs of all the local CPUs, the local I/O adapters, and the interconnect out to the rest of the system. And of course, then you have the low latency internode, low latency, hopefully high bandwidth internode interconnect, a sufficient bandwidth to handle all the off-node traffic between the nodes. And possibly you build these into a hierarchy of these things. Now, not to insult my audience, but this is a little slogan that in a previous life in another century when we did some NUMA development, we used to tell ourselves, because everybody talked about, oh, the latency, it's longer to go off-node, but it's really the bandwidth. Latency is important, but if you think about it, latency can basically decreases the effective bandwidth. If when you take a cache miss, you have to go off-node, get the data, and come back, every one of those takes longer. It decreases your effective bandwidth. And not only that, when we quote bandwidth, when we quote latencies on a system, we're typically quoting them. Like on our systems, we'll say, oh, a remote access is 1.7 times the cost of a local access. Well, yes, that's if you have no contention on the port into the system. Into the node and such. However, under contention, latency becomes a function of load. It's a queuing network. And you can get low or even inverse scaling or hotspots. And that's not a good thing. So, you know, like processor caches, on a NUMA system, we're heavily dependent on locality for a win. So I need to show you a couple of pictures. This is a node or cell in the systems I'm used to working on. Four processors, they might be multi-core, there might be multi-thread, they might share caches or not, but the real important thing is the four pipes coming down from the processors. Have some number of memory banks. Usually we build multiple memory banks because it's the bandwidth, and you want to amortize the cost of accessing those memory banks as you stride through them. Local I/O adapters, not all systems have these, some remote the I/O, and the port out to the rest of the system. Now, the total memory bandwidth available is whatever your local memory gives you. And then you have all these consumers of memory bandwidth. And hopefully this interconnect in the middle is large enough to satisfy that. And oh yeah, the internode port is both a provider and a consumer of memory bandwidth, because you can send off node requests out there and get results back from the other systems. Now we take these and we connect them together with an interconnect. This is sort of a schematic of the system I've been testing on mostly. 4 cells, 16 CPUs, single level interconnect. I don't have I/O on all of my cells, but I just took that picture and shrunk it and duplicated it 4 times. And then we can connect these into a hierarchy. And we have this would be like the HP Superdome. We have 16 cells, 64 CPUs, or sockets nowadays, because with Montecito, those are dual core. We have one of these in the lab that I've tested on a little bit with a terabyte of memory. That's fun to boot. So what I want to talk about a little bit is an approach to NUMA support. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's gone into the Linux kernel in terms of NUMA support and show you how the performance of the kernel has evolved on a NUMA system, and then show you that we still have room for improvement. So the first thing you want to do, and this is my digital background showing here, my DEC background, is you enhance the kernels that do the right thing. And what do I mean by that? First of all, reasonable, that is non-pathological default behavior. Okay, so what's non-pathological? If any of you saw Greg Banks making an NFS suck faster, he talked about a situation they had where for a fixed number of clients, if they added additional CPUs or resources to their server, throughput went down, capacity went down. To me, that's pathological. You know, customers just don't like that. So if you have good default behavior, you have to realize one size doesn't fit all. And so you need some configurable and tunable behavior for various applications, wallets, or even platforms. But the kernel, you know, really can't do it all. So we need a way to provide hints and application-specific information to the kernel. One way of doing that is inheritable attributes, or other directed, so you can change the attributes of another task. But say you can set by a command line tool like NUMA control. So I want to run this task with its memory over there. That way you can provide some environmental constraints and information to the kernel on an unmodified application. Then you also need APIs, system calls such as libNUMA. So you can create NUMA-aware applications, including those command line tools above, like NUMA control, some perhaps runtime environments. I worked with a OpenMP environment that knew how to parallelize over both massively parallel, you know, clusters, and it recognized our NUMA system and laid memory out correctly and scheduled threads, and all you had to do there was recompile and with some OpenMP directives, and you know. It might not be as good as a hand-tuned job, but it was better than just linear, non-NUMA-aware code. So, what have we been doing in Linux for NUMA support? Well, first thing, we ported Linux to NUMA platforms without any NUMA awareness. So you had to be aware of, you know, disconfig memory came in because NUMA platforms tend to have big holes in the physical memory. So you at least need to handle the platform specifics. But that doesn't give you a NUMA system. In fact, we at one time, we came out with a new NUMA system back at Digital, and marketing says, well, you know, it's a new hardware. People aren't going to want to buy new hardware and put on a new operating system because then they'll need new applications. So let's just ship this with our old non-NUMA OS. And we did, and customers didn't like it. So the first thing that went into Linux was a node-aware where you start getting per-node page pools, that is pre-lists, LRU lists, daemons and such, so that you can actually tell which memory is on which node and have a chance of allocating them there. Then at some point, Andy Clean, with others, Andy submitted the patch, or I think maybe Andrew submitted it on Andy's behalf, which provided reasonable default behavior, in my opinion, that is local allocation. So if you're running on a node and you touch, you know, your address space, you need to default it in, let's allocate a local node.
Is local allocation
Okay. So we now have the, okay, so Andy says the local allocation was there. There was no way to change it. It was sort of when they first made the page pools, it allocated locally. But the important thing that Andy added was these APIs, mbind, set and get memory policy. So you could specify policy for ranges of your address space or for the entire task. And if any of you have ever worked on older NUMA systems, some of this is a little counterintuitive how it works, but hey, you know, once you read the code, you can figure it out. And of course, the command line tool, NUMA control. Now, there's a couple of ways of managing locality. You can try to move your memory around to where your tasks are, or you can try to keep your tasks with your memory. And we now have some NUMA awareness in the scheduler domains. Effectively, it knows where the node boundaries are, and there's a little bit of inertia. There has to be more of an imbalance to move a task between nodes than, say, between CPUs on the same node. And I like to think of this, and some people may disagree with me, is all that remains of Eric Fox's early work on the Notifine scheduler. Now, what Eric had done, he was on top of the original O1 scheduler, is he had marked tasks with their home node, and he added sort of, you know, heuristics into the scheduler so that you always wanted to move a task back to its home node. If you had to pull something off a node, you'd rather pull off a task that wasn't native to that node because, you know, he was already away from home, so take him somewhere else. But the community deemed this as too intrusive. This was, you know, Ingo had just come out with this nice, pristine new O1 scheduler, and all these nasty NUMA changes were going in there. So they pared it down a little bit, and about all that remains is just, you know, awareness of the topology, and it's a little harder to migrate between nodes than between CPUs in a node, but, you know, that's what we have now. Another thing that came out, CPU sets, which are sort of resource and behavior container mechanisms. The original patch I saw was by Simon Durr of Bull, but the first patch that went in, I believe, was submitted by Paul Jackson, and he's the current sort of maintainer developer of this. And these allow you to, they allow you to assign resources to a CPU set, CPUs and memories, which are nodes, and then put tasks in there, and the tasks are constrained to run on those CPUs and allocate memory from those nodes. Now, if you're smart, or if you want to perform well, probably those memories and CPUs are from the same node. If you want to do some interesting testing, you can put CPUs from one node and memory from another, and you get what you get. But it also encapsulates behavior, and I mention this because I take advantage of this. For example, in the current upstream kernels, I think they're even in the distros that are coming out now, you can specify, for example, that in this CPU set, I want the page cache spread across all the nodes so I don't fill up memory in any one node, whereas the default is to just keep doing it local to where the task who caused the page to be brought into the page cache is executing. So now we're beginning to have some user-level ways of managing the system. More recently, starting late in 05, Christoph Lameter started submitting a series of patches that resulted in the direct synchronous page migration that showed up in 2.6.16. There was earlier work in the hot plug, the memory hot plug team had a memory migration for their purpose, and Ray Bryan of SGI put a NUMA migration on that, but that was kind of going nowhere. There were too many dependencies, so Christoph went, tried another way, and hey, he got it in, so there. There have also been some enhancements to the kernel memory allocators. Slab infrastructure, Christoph, again, the very prolific Christoph, sent in some patches there. So you could do kmemalloc node and specify in the kernel if you knew where you wanted your memory, like you knew where a device was located and you want to allocate in the driver some memory close to that device, you can specify that. And it's there for subsystems to use. The other thing Christoph did is made the slab obey task policy. So if I'm allocating in the kernel on behalf of a task, I'll use the task policy to do that. So what has this done for us? I'm going to show you some AIM-7 benchmark results. Now, those of you who saw my little mini kernel mini-conf talk, is that all you guys ever run? And it's no, that's not all we ever run. But the graphs actually show things very well. So it's very many, many tasks. It can run up to the tens of thousands. And it's exercising kernel scalability more than user space, because it's really not a huge memory footprint and such. I want to show you the results on an HP 8620 platform. This is a four node. This is that diagram, the first diagram I showed you. The interesting feature this platform has is because we run certain OSs which are somewhat less NUMA aware than Linux, we can actually interleave the hardware on a cache line basis before we boot. So it sort of looks like an SMP. And we'll call this SMP mode. We don't actually call it that. Fujitsu has, in their PrimeQuest, does something similar, and they call it SMP mode. And it's easier to write than fully interleaved or, you know, fully cell local memory. So I'll say SMP and NUMA. So the other mode is it looks like a NUMA system. But think about it. If I interleave on a cache line on a four-node system, three-quarters of my cache line are remote. You know, how can that be a win? It's the bandwidth. What you do is you get rid of hotspots. Yes, you might have a lot of off-node traffic, but they're spread among the remote nodes, just like memory references are spread among memory banks in a node. So it's the bandwidth. Now, I'm going to show results for a SLES 9 and a SLES 10 kernel, a 2.6.5 vintage with lots of patches, and a 2.6.16 with maybe not so many patches yet. And I chose the SLES. I see the same thing in RHEL 4 and the RHEL 5 betas, but since SUSE was first out with a new kernel that showed this behavior, I'm choosing them. In the 2.6.5, 2.6.9 time frame, we would see a NUMA penalty when we would configure our platforms as a SMP versus NUMA. So the top line, the green line, that's SLES 9 SP3 on the 16-way, 64 gig, 144 disks, file systems, and that's one line. Same hardware, same platform, same kernel image, same executable, but we reboot the system after configuring to all cell local memory, and we get the blue line, about a 7 to 10% on the various workloads degradation. And that's just where Linux was then. So guess what we recommended to our customers? Comes 2.6.16, SLES 10, and we see the upper two lines. The black line is SLES 10, the GA, General Availability Release, same system in the SMP mode. And the red line is same system, same hardware, same executable in NUMA mode. And now we get about a 5 to 7, depending on the different workloads, boost by going to NUMA. So to me, this is goodness. This says the kernel is moving in the right direction. Now, as far as the lines being different from each other, yeah, there's been a lot of development in Linux since then. And also, we build the AIM executable with the compiler that comes with the distro. So there's different compilers here and lots of other kernel changes. But if you think about it, I mean, it's the same kernel. So whatever the changes are, just flipping between NUMA and SMP mode, the effect is different in the older kernels than the new. We now see a benefit from NUMA. So that's goodness. But that's sort of kernel scalability. How about applications, especially applications that are sensitive to NUMA locality effects? I claim there's some room for improvement, and I'll show you why. So these applications tend to be large memory footprint, relatively high cache miss rate, which means they're sensitive to memory bandwidth. And they tend to be long-lived, meaning that unless you, you know, lock them down to a CPU, they're subject to load balancing. I'm going to simulate this using the McAlpin stream benchmark. And the reason I do that, it's specifically designed to measure memory bandwidth. And I claim it's all about the bandwidth. Bytes moved divided by byte of last time. So it'll move a bunch of data around between timestamps and say, okay, you move X megabytes in so many seconds, here's your throughput. Now, if I only ran one copy of that on one, you know, a single-threaded copy of that on one CPU, I would see the bandwidth. I'd see the bandwidth of that CPU. So what I did is I built this with the Intel compiler with OpenMP extensions, and it would run threads on all of the CPUs and all of the nodes. Now, the good thing about this is if we can arrange for all of the threads to access local memory, we get to claim the sum of all the nodes' bandwidth as our platform bandwidth, and marketing likes that. So here's a picture. Pretty colors. The data arrays, Stream works on three data arrays, copying them and adding and such. Walks down them. The colors represent threads. So if the threads are distributed across all the CPUs and they're each assigned a slice of the array, and so you'll basically take a timestamp, release all the threads, they process their slice of the array, you rendezvous, take a timestamp, and say, gee, I moved all that umpteen gigabytes of memory in such a time, so that's my bandwidth. And you had, in this case, 16 threads working on that. Now, this is the ideal configuration. The little boxes in the memory, the little colored boxes in the memory there, they're not meant to imply that it's contiguous there. It's just all the pages are there. Now, for any given distribution of threads across those CPUs, there's only one optimal distribution of the memory, and that is local to the threads. There's lots and lots of unoptimal, suboptimal configurations, and I didn't want to draw all those, so use your imagination. Think, for example, if all the memory was up there in node 0, like if I just kept allocating it all right there, I'm going to have all the remote nodes beating on, trying to get through that interconnect, queuing up at the port on node 0, trying to get in there. And, well, what do I see when I do that? I'm going to let the kernel have its way, because I trust the kernel. I'm not going to do any affinity. I'm not going to create any CPU sets. I'm going to just let it run. What do I see? I see run-to-run variability, apparently due to locality. No repeatability. This is something customers don't like. And I also, as I'll show you, see a disruption of if you do luck out and happen to hit the right config, any initial locality that you might have can be destroyed by internode load balancing. So what I did is I took and I ran the McAlpin stream 100 times. And each time, the way this runs, it runs through the arrays, does its thing 10 times, picks the minimum time, which gives you the maximum bandwidth, with the theory that things might interrupt you in your timestamp window, so you could get lower, but there's probably no external effects that are going to lie and give you a higher bandwidth or a shorter time. So on the far, what's that? That's your right. That about 35 out of 100 times, I actually got what's probably close to the peak bandwidth of this machine that you can, the effective bandwidth that you can actually utilize. However, two-thirds of them are all over the map. And I do tend, now every time I run this, I get a different graph, but it's always roughly this shape. Sometimes the different peaks are higher, but I always see some around the 12, 1300, around the 10,000, 8 to 10,000 and down lower. Now, just imagine if this were like an application that runs, supposed to run for a week, and if instead of running up at around 16 gigabytes per second, I'm running at 4 gigabytes per second, one-fourth the memory bandwidth. It may not take four times as long to complete, but it's going to take a lot longer to complete than 1 week. So locality is goodness here. So that's a static effect. You just throw a system. If you don't do anything, the kernel's not going to get it right for you necessarily. So how about the dynamic effects? Suppose I got on that far right, configuration. I got maximum bandwidth. Everything's nice and local. But I don't want to do any binding of these threads. It's not hard, but I don't want to do it. So I'm going to run the benchmark for sufficient time to allow a transient workload to run. So 10 times, I'm going to run it 500 times. And then I'm going to apply a transient workload. One of my favorite workloads is the kernel build, because I do it a lot. I'm going to do a 32-job parallel, because I tend to run two times the number of CPUs as the number of jobs, and that seems to be pretty good. And that's going to compete for the CPUs. And then I'm going to plot the completion time, which is inversely proportional to the bandwidth. I'm going to plot that at each one of these runs. And this is what I see. Now, the times here on your left, the 1 and 2, you'll see two lines. That's because the copy and scale operations do one load and one store. The add and triad do two loads in one store, so they take a little bit longer, but that's accounted for in the bandwidth calculations. But it starts out, those numbers, I can tell you, actually represent that spike at the far end. So that's goodness. And I did have to run a couple of times to get one that started at a good state. Because if I started at a bad state and ended, you go, yeah, so? So this is one that just happened to hit that good state. I ran it. That first green blip is where I mistyped the command to start the kernel build. And I thought a minute, do I want to restart this whole thing? No, let's go. So then you'll see some low blips that are make MR proper, make def config, and then a make all J32. And here's the tasks are being migrated, they're being interrupted, preempted, and then, oh yeah, I have kernel preemption on too. Let's make this fun. In the middle of they're running, they get migrated, they get preempted by the kernel build. In the middle of their timestamp, so you get these spikes artificially high. And when all is said and done, you come back to a steady state. And look at that steady state. Those times are about twice what the initial times were. And if you start integrating under there, you know you're going to take twice as long if this were a real, not an artificial benchmark. And again, I can run this, a lot, and sometimes I'll see the front go higher or lower. But I've never seen, after all the scrambling, ending up in a good place. I always seem to end up kind of scrambled. And I argue that the more nodes you have, the less likely you'll ever sort of just accidentally hit the right state. So what's happening? Without manual intervention, optimal placement has, one in three probability. And that will probably decrease with node count. And even with near optimal, placement, transient workloads destroy locality. Why not just bind the task to the CPU nodes? That's what the HPC guys do, but they got the money to buy the hardware. I would have said, but for other environments, you're wasting resources if you dedicate them to certain applications and things. But I found this one paper with this guy who's into high performance computing and OpenMP, and he was comparing OpenMP on clusters versus SMPs and NUMAs, and he claims, he's probably crazy, but he claims that the absence of easy fine-grained load balancing is a real barrier to scalability in this environment. And I go, wow, I would have thought, load balancing is what kills, certainly kills performance. So even some HPC guys don't necessarily want to lock down. And of course, in some environments, typically the so-called enterprise, they don't want to bother with it. It's like, hey, we're paying you big bucks for this thing. It better work. So can the kernel help? Now we're getting an auto page migration. See, it knows what it's doing. It knows when it's moving a task to a new node. That's built into the scheduling domains, and it knows where the CPUs are, which CPU it's proposing to move from and to. However, without sort of extensive or expensive page reference tracking and such, it can't even guess which pages will be referenced after migration. It can never know because, as they say in the mutual funds, past performance does not necessarily indicate future performance. This is especially true for multi-threaded applications where they're all, you've got threads everywhere, potentially touching all the pages in the application, potentially touching them. Still, I think, the kernel knows when it's moving things. If I could get the task to do some work on its own behalf when it gets to the new node, I can restore locality and charge it to the task itself. Of course, this costs something. Migration doesn't come for free, and I'll show you. Enter lazy automatic page migration. Same scenario, same kernel, didn't even reboot. My patches were in the previous one, and this one, I enabled them. And if you're saying, your patches might have had some impact, I'll show you later where I don't think they did. So I enable them, rerun, basically I put my shelf in which I launched these things into a CPU set that had it enabled, and run it. And you'll see a couple things. Here I started out in the bad way, in the bad place. Didn't mistype the command, so it started right off. First thing to note is the peaks are higher. I use the same scale so as not to disguise that fact. And in fact, the high peaks here go up to the order of about 1.2, 1.5, I think, because page migration costs. If you get interrupted, if you take a timestamp, start working on an array, and you get migrated to a new node and have to migrate those pages you're touching, in that timestamp, it's going to take longer. However, regardless of the initial state, every time I do this, I always end up at a final state where I have basically the optimal times. It always goes to a state of maximal locality. Because as tasks are migrating, how does it work? There's two major components, two major patch sets. One is called I call migrate on fault, or lazy migration. In a discussion with Christoph, he characterized it as sort of opportunistic migration. So what it does is it will migrate a page in the fault path if migrate and fault is enabled, because maybe not everybody wants to do this, and that's per CPU set. If the page has no PTEs referencing it, in other words, page underscore map count of page is zero, this is a good chance. It's not in anybody's page table, so you know, if I can lock it, I can. It's mine to do with what I want. If the page mapping has a migrate page op, it's another thing, because I don't want to use the fallback mechanism, which might involve writing out the disk, and I'm trying to optimize performance here. And then finally, as each one of these, you know, gates the following one, and if all of the above are true, then, and the page, I check the page location, I check the policy in the task context and compare it to the page where the page exists, and if it doesn't match, I will try to migrate the page. And I don't try too hard. I turn off the wait. I won't wait to migrate. I won't try to kick off the swap daemon. I won't let it overflow to another node because, you know, why do that? I mean, I want to bring it local. If I can't bring it local, just use it where it is. So there's several ways to bail out and short circuit if you, you know, don't want to take any of the long allocation paths. Now, the auto-migrate part of it, Christoph called it like opportunistic. This is where I create the opportunity for opportunistic migration. If auto-migration is enabled for a task, if it's in a CPU set with it enabled, it marks the task with migrate pending when the load balancer decides to migrate the task to a new node. Again, it knows. It goes, I'm going from this CPU to that CPU. That's from node 3 to node 2. Migrate pending. Now, when the task starts to return to user space, it sees that migrate pending, and it goes, oh, I'm going to, you know, prepare for lazy migration. So it'll walk its address space, and it'll remove the PTE references. It'll unmap all the pages that happen to be controlled by default policy or that are in VMAs controlled by default policy. I don't go down and actually look at the rank. Well, since we split VMAs for MBind, there's typically one policy per VMA, except for shared memory files that have shared policies, but those probably don't get unmapped. Not sure. If they're default, anyway, I unmap all the pages because it's only default policy where you care where you're located. If you're specific, if a page is specifically bound to some node, you know, it doesn't matter where you migrate the task. But if it's supposed to be local to the task, then I'll unmap it. If it's currently mapped in less than n other tasks address spaces, and by default that n is 1. In Christoph's direct migration, non-privileged tasks can only migrate pages if they're only mapped into their address space. But I wanted to be able to play with that without rebuilding and stuff, so I made it a tunable. Then, whoever the next time they're touched, since there's no PTE, you'll take a page fault and migrate on fault will pull them local. Now, it may not be the task that thought he was going to migrate them. If this is a shared page, some task on another node could touch it. Could be the node where the page exists, just reinstall the PTE. Could be another node, and this other task who's sharing the page touches it, he'll pull it there. That's to be expected. So now what I had here in my proposal, I said, if I have time, I'm going to go into the page migration in 2.6. But since I don't have time, and then show you the changes I made, but I think I want to get on to the performance results, because that's what's important here. It is configurable. Migrate and fault is separately configurable. And per CPU set, Paul Jackson would just love all the things I've added here and all the ifdef config this and that I've added to his CPU set.c. But it seems like I wanted to have some tasks and allow you to specify which tasks and which applications had this turned on. I didn't want to add these to all the proc PID subspace. So it seemed like with that page cache spreading and stuff, this was a reasonable way. So let's look at performance. Okay. I took this data on 2.6.19. I've since moved the patches forward, but didn't have time to rerun all the data and regenerate the slides, but I don't think it changes much. So, again, my favorite load is the parallel kernel build. And it's important that you not regress in kernel builds because kernel developers don't like that. With no patches, I run 11 runs, 11 kernel builds. I treat the first one as a page cache warming, throw it away, average and standard deviation for the second 10, and that's what you see here. So that's the baseline, no patches. If I install my patches, ooh, it goes faster. That always happens. So, you know, it's not like really a fluke. I always see this. So maybe things have just moved around in memory and I'm getting some little cache synchronicity or something, but but basically it's the same values. So now I'm just going to turn on migrate on fault. I'm not going to turn on auto migration. Now, real time's okay. Same user time, but I just used another 10, seconds of system time basically for nothing. We'll see what's happening there. And if I turn them both on, okay, now I start to regress the real time of the kernel build. The kernel developers are really upset. I gain a whole second of user time. But I pay it back in system time. So what's going on here? So I did some instrumentation and counting things. With migrate on fault only during the kernel build, 7.25 million PTE faults, you see it here. Of those page faults, 500,000 of them had zero map count in the cache. So it's like, hey, let me check them out. Of those, 346,000 were not on the right node. So let me try to migrate them. And I was successful in all but about 1K. So I don't know whether there was no memory on that node or whatever, but I didn't record why. If I turn on migrate on fault, now so that 2714 says that's how many times I had a task migrate between nodes during this build. And I went in and scanned the page tables. But I didn't find a whole lot of pages. Out of all that, I only found 7,000 pages to migrate that I scanned. And of that, I only chose 2,500 that had the right map count or were in the right state that they could migrate. Now you'll start to see, since a lot of those were probably non-pages, I had to push them to the swap cache because my mechanism requires that in case they could be shared. And you'll see I start to get swap faults. And that adds those 2K swap faults add to the pages checked for misplacement. Few less happen to be misplaced. Again, this is statistical. But then I turned off page cache migration and did only anon. And you can see similar. This one happened to find more pages and migrate a few more of them. But let me show you the next thing. So what's really happening here? So when I looked at the traces of those page cache pages, I saw the same page just thrashing all over the place. Maybe it was a page of the compiler text, and a task would run on node 1, and the page would be on node 2, so it would pull it over, and then he would end, and then the task would start up over here, and I need that page, and he'd pull it over here, and on throughout the whole thing. So my conclusions, draw your own, are that unconditional migration of these page cache pages is maybe not such a good idea. Okay, I admit that. However, given that we've got tasks on all these nodes that want to reference these pages starting up, here and there, we might consider replicating shared read-only pages as future work. Now, the guys from Virtual Iron have a patch that does this back in SLES 9. I've grabbed the patch, and it's sort of there. If I ever get time and this ever goes anywhere, maybe I'll look at that. But for now, I don't think I want to do that. So if I do if I turn off migration on page cache pages and only do anon, I get a whole second or so speed up, a little bit less kernel time, and the one, so you're still paying the 1 second of system time versus the 65 seconds up at the top to do the migration in that. So, that's not stellar. However, on a heavily load, that was on a system standalone, but when I was running those transient workloads against streams, I noticed something. And it started to give me some hope. So the two lines are the disabled and anon pages only from the previous slide. And then you see with streams running. Now, streams wants to use up the whole system, right? It's just beating on memory. And you get these set of times, quite a bit longer, quite a bit more system time, even more user time than in the case of when you have the system to yourself. So this is a little disabled. However, when I enable it, I get about 17% improvement in runtime, about a 22% improvement in system time, and now it's a 4 or 5% improvement in user time. So, you know, this is sort of the hygiene aspect. In Dave Miller's presentation this morning, I heard him mention entropy is good. Well, that may be true in a random page pool, but in the locality of your pages versus the location of your task, entropy is not good. And in long-running applications and long-running systems, you tend to build up entropy as you go around and touch pages on different systems. Unless you do something, either manually, externally, or have the kernel do this, you know, you will build up entropy. You'll build up, you know, it's like hardening of the arteries, and the system just doesn't work as well. So status of the patches, you'll see this in the slides. You know, they're maintained separately. They are out on a place where you can look at them, where you can grab them. I did submit them once. Didn't get a lot of support because all I had was those first numbers. It's still incumbent on me to get some more real workloads, and we're working on that, but this is kind of a background job for me. I've got some size information on IE64. I included a couple of other patch things that I typically run with these in the build because that's what I had to look at, and about 12K on an IE64 and 5.5K on an x86-64. If you're wondering about the patch source code lines, the patches have disk stats in them. I didn't record that. I've tested this on some pretty big systems. It holds up well. I did find some races in the page cache migrate on fault, which I've fixed at the cost of some more overhead, but maybe that's moot anyway. But if you want to know more about that, or if you want to know about the internals of this, I have more slides that I skipped over. Some references here for you. I mentioned some papers up front. You can go look at them. There's also the Martin Bly OLS reprint 2004 has another NUMA on Linux systems that gives you more of the background. Christoph has a nice overview here. You can look at those. And we probably don't have time for questions, but you know, that's what I had.
Any questions? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile.
Those earlier graphs that showed the improvement after the kernel workload, would they have showed an improvement if no workload, other workload took place?
Well, if nothing migrated the tasks, if nothing migrated the streams, once they got up and running, the stream tasks, they would have just stayed there. So at this point, you actually have to perturb them. So now the question becomes, and I've actually investigated this a little bit, is there something I can do externally? And one of the things I didn't mention, I did add one control to the proc pid, you know, subdirectories, and that is a migrate. And when you touch that, it's as if you just migrated to another node. It'll cause the task, when it next goes to user space, to do all the unmaps and then redo that. So this was something I was discussing with Mike Giganti from SGI, and he says, oh, you know, if you do that, then I could get my NFS daemons all with local memory and stuff. So I went and tried. It was real easy to add. I just poked the task with migrate pending, and then when it runs, it didn't have to migrate anywhere, but it thinks it did. It did all the unmapping, and it goes ahead, and then things settle back out. So I did create an external control. So you don't have to turn on automatic, but you can still say, for this one task, sort of unmap all its pages and let it fault them back where they belong.
Is it at all reasonable to expect the system to move to the optimum state for locality?
Pardon?
Is it reasonable to expect the system to find optimum locality?
I don't know if it's reasonable, but I think it's very desirable. And if we can make it do that, then it's reasonable. Would anybody disagree that, yeah, I don't want it to do that, I don't care? I mean, there are people who don't care, right? I mean,
is it possible for you to go for a bit of a hybrid approach and actually have tasks you're fairly certainly going to be short-lived pinned to a particular node? So perhaps have make, when it's doing a kernel build, pin the compilers it runs to particular nodes, but let everything else migrate.
I think you could do that. You know, in HPUX, they have a command called chatter, which you can go in and in the elf image or whatever, then set attributes that then the exec can see. and at exact time it can do that, so like what sort of page size you want to use. So if we had this ability to annotate executables, and I think it was Steve Lagerbeam of Monte Vista was trying to do something like that for pages. You could do that, yes.
You could use pr-kittle and actually have it inherited from the parent.
Pardon?
You could perhaps use pr-kittle and actually inherit that thing from the parent.
Yes. Yep. You can use prefix commands and such. Yep.
Have you considered the case of using it, building on top of this existing migration work for doing a local node defragmentation?
Well, we have discussed that with Ian and I versus for the super pages and others about. I mean, it seems like the migration mechanism is there. This automatic migration is more for the benefit of tasks. Now, I'm just using in the low levels Christoph's direct migration. Certainly, defrag could also, if it had a way of scanning, intelligently scanning lists and things, it could also call into the current existing, independent of my work, could call into the existing migration.
Well, I guess that's the issue, is whether the scanning has to be done in the background or whether there's a hook that can be done in place from this existing lazy migration work that you're building.
Well, you're motivated differently, right? In one case, this guy just wants a page local. In the other case, you want to find specific pages that when I evacuate them, they become, I end up with a contiguous page.
But it depends if you're working on, I guess in the NUMA case, or if you're only working on a single system. As far as whether we can do, I mean, the migration hooks are already in place. So if you're only running on one particular system, then that could be used theoretically for coalescing the pages and moving them there directly.
I mean, I agree with you, but I'm not sure I understand, so we should probably talk this. But, I mean, certainly the mechanisms are there, and I believe there are discussions about using migration to do defragmentation. Christoph and Mel Gorman and such have been talking about this.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Lee.
Okay, thank you.